In 1815, James Riley, the captain of the merchant brig from Connecticut, and his crew set sail across the Atlantic for trade and adventure. Off the coast of North Africa, they were shipwrecked, captured by desert nomads, and sold as slaves in the Sahara. Eventually, Captain James Riley was rescued and lived to tell the horrifying tale of his enslavement in a memoir published in 1817. It was called Riley's Narrative and became one of the best-selling books of its day. The book is said to have helped turn many people's opinion against the institution of slavery, including a young reader by the name of Abraham Lincoln. Despite its popularity at the time, it has long been out of print. In 1995, author Dean King, an authority on nautical literature and history, stumbled upon the story in his research on another project. His fascination with the story led him to retrace Captain Riley's voyage and recount his story in a new book called Skeletons on the Sahara, A True Story of Survival. Dean King joins us now here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
Now, you stumbled on this book by accident. Did you reckon, what attracted it to you?
Well, on the spine, the book also goes by Sufferings in Africa, and I saw that, and I was intrigued. I pulled it down, cracked it open, and I couldn't put it down. For 2 days, I read nothing but that book, and one thing led to another, and I sort of had an obsession with it at a point and decided that I wanted to retell the story.
We hear tell of the stories of young Abraham Lincoln reading by firelight there in the cabin in Kentucky. What evidence is there that he actually did read this book, though?
Well, the 1860 campaign biography by John Locke Scripps mentions this book as one of the six books that Abraham Lincoln read as a boy.
So this was an author, presumably Lincoln reviewed the manuscript?
That manuscript?
Yeah, his own biography, yeah.
Oh, exactly, yes.
Yeah, so he would have...
That was the only biography that he did, in fact, authorize and review.
Now, describe what happened to Captain Riley. He and... there were a dozen sailors on the ship that were wrecked on the shore, and eventually, after a sea voyage in a leaky boat, they washed ashore again. They tried to escape, but as you describe it, the Sahara at that time was as foreign to them as Antarctica would be to somebody today.
It was, and really, James Riley inadvertently became the first ethnographer of Western Sahara. He's still quoted today. It's that remote of an area. When they climbed up the bluffs and reached the Sahara, they were about to expire. They had not eaten or drunk in quite a while, and they saw a fire, and they went to the fire, and that's where these desert nomads captured them.
And sold them off into slavery.
Well, they actually carted them across the desert a good bit. The men were stripped naked because their clothing was valuable. And so they were under the Saharan sun riding these camels. And a camel trot is pretty brutal. It's known as a rack. And they would, at times, they were running through steaming sand or over the rocky desert. You know, about four-fifths of the Sahara is really this hard, rocky desert. And so they suffered miserably. And finally... they were also divided amongst this tribe, the tribe, the Ulidbuspa. But finally, a trader from the north rode into the camp, and Riley persuaded him to buy him and four of the men.
And eventually, they met good masters and bad, but eventually they did get out.
They did, yes. And this man, Sidi Hamet, Riley formed a bond with. And I think that's the really neat thing about this story, is that the two of them worked together to go 800 miles across the Sahara to reach Essaouira, where the men were ransomed.
Given what happened to him and his crew, and not all of them made it, was Captain Riley bitter about the people he met and his experience?
Riley was largely... very understanding of the people in certain ways, and the bond he formed with the Sidi Hamet, he came to respect Hamet immensely. Hamet led them to springs in the desert where there was no apparent water, and he navigated the various tribes very skillfully. Hamet even fought his own brother. Hamet also thought Riley was a man blessed by God because of the troubles they were escaping, and he fought his own brother, and he was determined to take these people to freedom. His brother wanted to sell them back down into the desert at a certain point because they had to go through a series of warlords, and Sidi Hamet's own father-in-law was a warlord who he owed money to and wanted to sell the men as well. So it was this bond, I think, that convinced Riley to look at the people there as real people and not as not to stereotype them.
And similarly, when he got back and wrote his book, Clearly, Americans were pretty familiar with the concept of slavery. They were less familiar that a person, a white person, like many of the readers of the book, would be sold into slavery.
True, and in many ways, Riley brought back a voice for African Americans didn't have a voice. They couldn't speak out on the horrors and suffering of slavery, but Riley, as a white man, could do that. And I think it had a very powerful effect. Clearly, you know, Abraham Lincoln, I think, was affected by that.
How popular was the book?
Riley was a household name in 1817. The book was serialized in newspapers up and down the coast. The publishing industry wasn't such that they could produce a big bestseller, but it was continually republished in small batches around the country. But there's even a case of a man in South Carolina who named his son C.D. Hammett after Riley's captor, the man who freed him.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, in the book, after his own experiences as a slave, does Captain Riley speak about the institution of slavery in this country?
He did, in fact. He went on to become a congressman in Ohio. He was also a surveyor in Ohio. And he spoke out. He wrote letters against slavery, against admitting any more slave states.
And one of the fascinations of this story is, you know, how popular this book was all those years ago, how influential, and then it sort of vanished from the national consciousness.
It did, although even up into the 1870s, there's evidence that it was widely read by young people and as an adventure tale. It has the ability, Riley's writing, to reach out past its time. Many shipwreck narratives and sailor narratives of that period are stilted and hard to read, but mm-hmm. but Riley had a certain sensibility, I think, that allowed it to transcend his age. But in the 20th century, it had been completely forgotten, so much so that Richard Slotkin, who wrote a wonderful biographical novel about Abraham Lincoln, and lives in Middletown, the town that Riley's ship departed from, didn't even know the story.
Middletown, Connecticut.
Yes, Middletown, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went back and retraced it, at least parts of Riley's trip. We just have a minute or so left, but tell us some of the highlights.
It was fascinating. I'd planned to go. It was the week after 9/11, and of course that turned the world on its head. And I had to make a decision a couple weeks later whether I actually wanted to go or not, and decided that if I didn't go then, I might never go. And when I got over there, it was very tense. Landed in Layoun, Western Sahara, which is, since the Spaniards left, it was Spanish Sahara. The Moroccan government controls it, and it's very much the military and the police control the territory. So
disputed territory.
Yes, yes. It's very heavily landmined as well. So I was able to drive down the coast and find the spots where he wrecked, and then to take camels up through part of his route as well.
And, you know, taking a camel ride even today is, I suspect, did you bring a cushion?
The saddles were straw donuts, and we did 100 miles, but I'll tell you, after the very first day, I had worn a hole through the seat of my pants.
The extraordinary space through which you traveled, I wonder, from reading the book and the descriptions of the people that you read in Riley's narrative, how much have they changed?
They haven't changed much, and it was really fascinating. Things that even at the time the book was written, people were skeptical of, I was finding were still true. The fact that they rely on drinking camel milk, their medical treatment of heating up a blade in the fire and applying it to different parts of the body. Still, you know, when I talk to my guides, my desert guides, they still live this way.
You talk about the reception of the book, that it was, some critics said, you know, he made it up.
Exactly. You know, the fact that somebody would actually brand themselves with a knife to cure themselves of an illness, people found far-fetched. The fact that they could live on camel milk, one meal of camel milk a day, was considered preposterous by his critics. And there were other instances of things that that when I went over there, I was actually surprised myself to find were still true today.
Dean King, thanks very much for coming back and telling us the story.
Thank you, Neil.
Dean King's the author of Skeletons on the Zahara, A True Story of Survival. By the way, he spells it the old-fashioned way with the Z-A-H-A-R-A. And he was with us here in Studio 3A.